the War in Ukraine Update from Kyiv podcast. I'm Jessica Ganawa, a lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia. As regular listeners would know by now, our frequent podcast guest, Maxim Yali, professor of international relations at the National Aviation University in Kyiv, grew up himself in the city of Mariupol. Maxim left Mariupol in 2006 to go and live in Kyiv. However, he returned frequently to the city. He still had a house in Mariupol. Maxim returned to Mariupol in 2014 and was there during the time of the previous Russian-backed incursions into the city of Mariupol. So I thought that I would ask Maxim today to explain more about what happened in Mariupol in 2014 from his perspective. Maxim begins by noting that the Russian incursions into Ukrainian territory began in 2014 with the occupation and later annexation of Crimea. Over to Maxim.
As you know, it started in Crimea in 2014 when there were Russian troops, Russian soldiers dressed in Russian uniform, but without chevrons, flags, etc., etc. And Putin was saying, it is not our soldiers. Everybody can go to the military shop and buy this uniform. But then a few years after, in a propagandist documentary to Solovyov, he was telling how he was planning the operation, that it was under his control, that it was Russian troops, etc., etc.
The annexation of Crimea was followed by Russian-backed separatist movements taking control of bits of territory within mainland Ukraine. Maxim next broadly describes the situation in Mariupol in early 2014 when Russian-backed rebel groups took control of the city council. Then, from March to June 2014, there were ongoing skirmishes between Russian-backed pro-Russian forces and pro-Ukrainian forces, primarily represented by the Azov Regiment that was discussed in this podcast previously. The city was then reclaimed through the fighting of primarily the Azov forces in June 2014. Let's pick back up with Maxim talking about the original occupation of Mariupol in early 2014.
So it was actually under occupation in spring 2014. There was even a referendum, so-called, in Mariupol, as well as in Donetsk, in all Donbass and Luhansk regions. So there were two authorities at the same time, Ukrainian and of so-called Donetsk People Republic. They occupied the local council, city council. There were troops there, but they were not so numerous. In June, during one day, Azov Regiment set it free. So for Mariupol, it was, I would say, a lucky chance that they were not occupied by then. But the problem is that there was a hesitation of Ukrainian authorities. They kept negotiations. And as I told you, for more than a month or about two, it was under so-called Donetsk People Republic.
You've mentioned before that you were in Mariupol in 2014. Were you living there at the time?
Well, luckily, at that time, I already didn't live in Mariupol. I lived in Kyiv, but I came there after it was set free by Azov Regiment in June 2014, and I stayed there for a month and a half. I was there when there was a next attempt to occupy it, already by Russian regular troops. They came up on the 24th of August, it was Independence Day in Ukraine, and their tanks were 30 kilometers away from Mariupol, from the east, and it was a danger that they would start offensive, and I was trying to evacuate my family, my mother, my wife, my small son there, so it was a unique experience, I would say.
As Maxim noted, after June 2014, when Mariupol came back under the control of Ukrainian forces, skirmishes and fighting still continued until after The Minsk agreements were signed, firstly in September 2014, and then a second agreement was signed in February 2015. Back to Maxim, as he explains how the fighting simmered down after those agreements were concluded.
After Minsk agreements in February 2015, the situation more or less calmed down because the fights kept going on since 2014 until the, I would say, April, May 2015 in the outskirts of Mariupol. It was just like 20 kilometers away and the fights were really strong and severe and constant shelling, etc., etc.
In episode 4, you described what it was like growing up in Mariupol as a Russian speaker and that people of an older generation who grew up under the Soviet Union often retained a pro-Russian sentiment. Though this was not so much the case for younger generations, you explained. What was the mood like in Mariupol in 2014?
There were some pro-Russian moods. A lot of people supported it at that time, those who were watching Russian propaganda and who still didn't know what it would be like. I mean, life in these territories, they believed that Soviet Union will be restored. They believed in all that propaganda fairy tales.
One of the aspects of the conflict in 2014 that caught attention outside Ukraine was its hybrid nature. That is, the use of military forces by Russia whilst simultaneously denying that Russian forces were involved in the incursions into Ukrainian territory. This hybrid strategy seemed to be quite effective for Russia at the time and partly contributed to why commentators and analysts thought that Russia would continue with this strategy in 2022, following the buildup of troops on Ukrainian borders, rather than engaging in an explicit full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Can you talk a bit more about those hybrid aspects of Russia's incursions into Ukraine in 2014?
Yes, it was a kind of, that's why it was called a hybrid war. Firstly, they didn't use regular armed forces, but for the first time they used it in late August 2014, as I mentioned, and it was close to Mariupol when I was there. And you see, they didn't put a flag, Russian flag, on tanks. They demarked all the signature numbers of groups, army, etc., which is usually done. That was a hybrid war until 2022, though everybody knew, you know, that it was Russia. It was obvious that coal miners, as Putin said, who found these heavy weapons underground, as he said. It was like, you know, he joked in that way, sarcastic, I would say. It was obvious for everybody that Russia kept supplying with military weapons that occupied territories for all that years. The first so-called prime minister of Donetsk People's Republic was KGB officer, FSB, officially with Russian citizenship. So even the heads of occupational administration have always been Russians. Those who are now Pushilin and Pasichnik, the heads of so-called People Republics, have Russian citizenships. So everybody knew that there were Russian troops inside Donetsk and Lugansk, and at least then all generals, all authorities were Russians. Russian generals, everybody knew it. It was obvious for everybody. When even I was on Russian TV, there was a member of parliament of Russia, and I read his interview when he said that it was a mistake that they didn't occupy Mariupol in 2014. And I was asking him, so it was you, it was Russian troops, if you say us, yes. And he became furious because I caught him on his mistakes.
Thanks, Maxim. Talk to you again soon.
To the bank, okay. you decided to sunbathe. It was a sign. We are ran off time.
You've been listening to the Update from Key podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.